And we were into it. January 1st, 1867. Our century.
It seems there is to be a new kingdom to the north of us. The new Canadian Confederation is to be officially known as the Kingdom of Canada. But the ruler is to bear his old title of Governor General with double the salary of a President of the United States. Is not this instituting of a new kingdom a breach of the Monroe Doctrine?
The new year came to Victoria amid the ringing of the Presbyterian church bell and the firing of guns. Many young gentlemen went calling upon their ladies. At some homes there were as many as 60, and would have been more except for a slight shower of rain.
Ottawa yesterday was alive for the celebration. The streets were full of cutters, sleighs, and all sorts of rigging upon runners. And the stores were as thronged as at Christmas. In some of the back streets where people had begun to celebrate too early, there was some brawling and fighting. We witnessed some of this, but considering the time, we refrained from printing names. We also refrained from calling the editor of the Citizen a burly swill tub, as was once done. But let him look out.
Century. Impressions of the 100 years that have seen the making of our nation. For this first day of the centennial year, we have gone to the memoirs and the history books and the archives, to files of dusty newsprint, and to the lively, living voices of Canadian writers, seeking to compose from among them all at least the hint of a pattern, some sense, however vague, of the great, baffling entity, the sum of achievements and frustrations that we celebrate this year. Hardly a word that follows is our own. These are Canadians who speak to you, or Canada viewers who have come to see us. Each, like the wise men of Hindustan, has seen his part of the elephant. None would claim more, nor do we claim it for them. There is only here a man or two, a moment or two, a glimpse or two out of the many millions. Telling what? How can we tell, who do not know ourselves? That answer is your own.
The arrival of our winter goods from Britain via the mail steamers Cuma and Asia, we're enabled to offer our patrons of Halifax an excellent assortment of cottons, linens, chintzes, delaines, checked wincies, plain wincies, knickerbockers, coburgs, poplins, opera hoods, Garibaldi pockets, Melton shawls, frilled shawls, ferns.
Two messages have lately been sent through the new Atlantic cable, the one from Mrs. Monahan and the other from Mr. J.A. MacDonald of Summerside. The messages cost $125 in gold.
The latest curiosity to be seen in Charlottetown is the single-seated steam wagon imported for Reverend Mr. Belcourt of Rustico.
Yesterday, a strange lady with two bundles in her arms called at the home of Mr. Lewis Muttert in Cape Traverse and asked for a night's lodging. Depositing her two bundles on a bed, she went out, saying that she'd left something in the carriage. When she did not return, it was discovered that the first bundle contained an infant, and the second, the baby's clothes.
Joy to the world! It is our pleasure to announce through the esteemed columns of this newspaper that Perry Davis Painkiller has been introduced to suffering humanity.
Good news for all. Mr. James Ramsden wishes to inform the citizens of Kingston that he has on hand a number of coffins of oak, pine, and walnut at all prices, and 40% less than any other establishment. He wishes to state that he never sells second-hand coffins.
A stranger from Belleville, who gave his name as Patrick Bars, was hailed before Magistrates Court yesterday, charged with being a vagrant. He had a desire to go to sea for the good of his health, and admitted that he had been 13 years from Ireland and had not washed himself during that time. The magistrate ordered him to be well washed, after which he was to have the fullest possible permission to go to sea.
Mr. W.P. Lett has received a New Year's gift of a meerschaum pipe from the Queen Fire Company. A rejected suitor threw a bucket of molasses over the bonnet of his loved one as she came from church yesterday.
My lover is a soldier boy.
One Mary Bone, who is on the shady side of 50 and excessively ugly withal, contracted a violent regard for a young soldier of the 100th Regiment and chose the unseemly hour of 3 o'clock each morning to visit the barracks, where, not at gaining admission, she would stand outside and croak forth in her own inimitable style such appropriate ditties as My Lover is a Soldier Boy and the like. Yesterday morning, Policeman Vachon came upon her while so engaged, and after a good deal of trouble, marched her way to jail. On his worship's ordering her to the cells for a week, she seemed to be perfectly indifferent.
I've been to the barracks before, and I will again, my lad, in spite of anybody's teeth.
£70 has been raised at Fort Garry for the building of a Presbyterian church.
We hear that at Portage la Prairie, a calf with two heads was born.
We hear that there are 20 lodges of Sioux at Portage, and Pachito is said to have obtained the consent of the Manitoba Chippewas to attack them in the spring.
Buffalo are reported to be abundant in the neighborhood of the south branch of the Saskatchewan.
Most teams for the Kootenays got through with the winter supplies. Our correspondent from the Lillooet reports the weather remarkably fine. The 10 mule teams of the Bokolupi Nelson and Company are running on the portages. Plowing was continued till the 4th of December, and...
In the Caribou, Mr. H.C. Wilmot, while engaged in hauling a heavy load of merchandise from Cameronton to Barkerville, was backed with his dray over the bank in front of Loring's saloon and received the full force of the falling vehicle, but escaped injury, except being scorched by a box of matches in his pocket that became ignited by the fall. The dray was broken.
British Americans all, Canadians yet to be, going about their business, even as you and I, on that first day of January, 1867.
At 12:05 midnight, June 30th, a salute of 101 guns was sounded in Ottawa, signifying a salutation of welcome to the new Confederation. Simultaneously, all the city bells rang out, and the bonfire on the ordnance lands opposite the Capitol was lighted, and speedily blazed up, illuminating the vast multitude of people.
God bless our newborn nation, stern empire of the North, pure offspring of high council, fair child of patriot worth. Flag is our flag, to bear through fame or loss. Britannia's flag of freedom, the glorious triple cross.
After the parade, the troops were dismissed at City Hall. Colonel Powell told the Carleton Battalion that no provision having been made by the city for their refreshment, Alderman Rochester had invited them to his grove. Captain Holmes objected, since Alderman Rochester was to be the candidate opposing him for the representation of Carleton in Parliament, and invited some of the volunteers to lunch at Graham's Hotel at his expense. Nevertheless, some of the troops went to the grove, where Alderman Rochester stood on a table to inform them that he would go through the county immediately and deny his opponent's allegations.
For the procession, which we may call the principal feature of the day's rejoicing in Halifax, about 600 people, as many as have occasionally attended a decent funeral, were all that could be scraped up. Flags were borne, bands played, and hats of considerable rustiness were waved in the air by those who thus chose to exhibit themselves gratis to the public.
You have succeeded, gentlemen. You have obtained a temporary triumph. But you have killed nationality. Confederation will be the tomb of the French race.
A sickly young newspaper editor in the woods of the eastern townships, by name Wilfrid Laurier.
I see George Brown is still at his antediluvian idea, an Upper Canada party on his principles.
Darcy McGee, father of Confederation, speaks of that other father.
True model of a Confederate statesman. It is thus we inaugurate the new era with the old war cries and the old madness. Quebec, I suppose, will organize into a solid phalanx next. that Nova Scotia Onontio Joseph Howe has already his sectional party on the stocks, and so we go. These patriots are to go into union without one common union principle agreed on between them, each making himself a general of division to scramble for the office of commander-in-chief at Ottawa. Yet that is Brown's patriotism and Brown's statesmanship. It's sickening to think that such a bladder can find followers.
Godspeed the new dominion, thus praise each patriot soul. Its flanks are mighty oceans, its base the northern pole. Oh, noble is the royalty for earnest men to sway. Then banish fears and crown with cheers our first dominion day.
October and the first of the general elections. John A. MacDonald reports.
We have carried everything before us in the two Canadas and New Brunswick. Our majority is, in fact, too large. Nova Scotia, on the other hand, has declared as far as she can against Confederation, but she will be powerless for harm. Although that pestilent fellow Howe may endeavor to give us some comfort.
You will ask me, I suppose, what if I cannot obtain repeal of union? I'm not prepared to say, but you may recollect the story of the Western camp meeting in which somebody put snuff into the horn with which the preacher called his congregation to battle. When he used the horn, of course, he blew snuff all over the flock. And then, preacher though he was, he pulled up his sleeves and said, I am a man of peace and have been preaching for 40 years, but show me the cuss that put the snuff in the horn.
'69. Over and done, that trouble. Howe subdued. There was, after all, only snuff in the horn.
You have got us, and now you have got to keep us.
The Intercolonial hacks through the eastern woods. Out of the far northwest, the other cry.
Have you heard anything lately as to what's to be done with this country?
The Red River Country, the land of the dark-skinned Métis, the land of Louis Riel. Governor MacDougall goes out, and Governor MacDougall turns back. The commander-in-chief in Ottawa reports,
You see, we have commenced the extension of our sovereignty with a war. It appears that the half-breeds have been soured by all kinds of stories as to the intention of Canada to deprive them of their lands and to govern without reference to the residents.
A father of Confederation sets out on a journey. Charles Tupper of Halifax.
My only daughter, Emma, had married Captain D.R. Cameron and accompanied him with Governor MacDougall and the other members of the party to Pembina. When, however, MacDougall reached the Hudson's Bay post, 2 miles north of the U.S. boundary, he was met by 25 armed half-breeds with an order from Riel forbidding him to remain in the territory on pain of death. Captain Cameron was taken prisoner and sent back to Pembina with his wife. When my poor wife learned of the position of our only daughter, she was much alarmed. She told me I must go at once and bring her home. I left Halifax by steamer on December 3rd, bound for New York, and went from New York to Ottawa by train. There, Sir John MacDonald bade me farewell.
I hope you will be able to go into Fort Garry, as no letter has reached us from there. And we are absolutely ignorant of what is taking place.
I set out from Ottawa on December 13th with Mr. D.A. Smith and Mr. Hardesty. The temperature was 30 degrees below zero. We reached Chicago via Toronto on the 14th and St. Paul at 9 a.m. on the 15th. On the 16th, we reached St. Cloud at the terminus of the railroad. Thence, we took a sled, covered with canvas and drawn by a pair of horses. We reached Georgetown at 6 p.m. on the 20th. This was a Hudson's Bay post, the only house left standing when the Sioux Indians rose in rebellion 7 years ago, massacred all the men and carried off all the women and children. We left Georgetown at 6 a.m. on December 21st and arrived at Fort Abercrombie at 2 p.m. Next day, we struck across the treeless prairie, making the points on the Red River for dinner and night. There was about a foot of snow on the ground, which we cleared away with a shovel, put an India rubber cloth on the ground, our mattress over that, and then our blankets and buffalo skins over all. We reached Grand Forks on the 22nd at 10:30 p.m., started at 4:30 a.m. on the 23rd, and reached North River at 8:30 p.m. As the horses became very tired, we walked the last 8 miles. It was very cold. We camped halfway between Salt River and Little Salt River. On the 24th, we started 8 a.m. after a cold night and bad dreams. Reached Big Point at 1 p.m., 80 miles from Pembina. Stopped at Two Rivers for tea and drove on to Pembina, which we reached at 11 p.m. on Christmas Eve. We located the house that Captain Cameron was occupying, and when I walked into the room, my daughter sat up in bed.
Why, Papa, what did you come for?
July 1st, 1871. Victoria, British Columbia.
At an early hour, flags waved from every flagstaff, and business was generally suspended in honor of the fourth anniversary of the Dominion of Canada. Dr. Powell presented the fire chief, representing the fire department, with a handsome Dominion flag. And the chief responded, as well as we could get it down,
"This Dominion flag is now to us a stern reality. Already is the great and glorious voice of union heard throughout the length and breadth of our country, and its harmonies reverberating along the valleys and the snow-clad peaks, which stand like giant sentinels upon our shores, ascending around and upward as if imploring heaven's smile upon the great and glorious change. We are now on the eve of confederation with the Dominion of Canada."
And 2 years later, by the other sea, Lord Dufferin, the Governor General, to Macdonald.
"I found the island in a high state of jubilation and quite under the impression that it is the Dominion that has been annexed to Prince Edward Island."
The Governor General's lady and her glimpses. A father of Confederation come to rest.
Down the St. Lawrence, we heard some music, the Dead March being played. And looking out, we saw, passing slowly in the darkness, with the chapel on board lighted up, the band playing, and bells tolling at sea, answered by bells tolling on shore, the steamer carrying home the body of Sir George Cartier. Tonight in Montreal, we attended a snowshoe torchlight procession. They wore white blanket coats, tight leggings, and red caps. In the bright night, on the snow-covered ground, with hundreds of sleighs and torches and thousands of tinkling bells, the procession moved up the mountain, a fiery serpent winding among the trees. Two men dined with us last evening. The one, the Speaker of the Legislature of Manitoba, who has lately been tarred and feathered by the people.
And out beyond the west of the tar and feathers, prairie and Indian and the buffalo still. The west of Fort Hoopup and the whiskey traders.
"Ordinarily speaking, no more wildly impossible undertaking was ever staged then the establishment of Canadian authority and Canadian law throughout the western provinces by a handful of mounted police.
Out of Toronto and Winnipeg by Fargo, North Dakota. Up to the border and west. 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
300 men in 6 troops, 310 horses, 142 work oxen, 114 carts, 73 wagons, 33 head of beef cattle, 2 9-pound guns and 2 mortars.
They are to be purely a civil, not a military body, with as little gold-laced fuss and fine feather as possible. Not a crack cavalry regiment, but an efficient police force for the rough and ready, particularly ready, enforcement of law and justice.
Our guides had deserted us or proved to be useless. I was navigating by the southern stars. By July 28th, the horses were giving out and rations were cut down. The grasshoppers had eaten all the grass for the horses. The country was alive with them.
Couldn't open your mouth, but the damn things filled it. They floated like scum on the rivers and piled up 2 feet deep on the banks, stinking like death.
We began to come into timber country, and miles of road had to be cleared for the wagons. Assiniboine war parties looked us over and vanished. A party of half-breed hunters with a Catholic priest, ponies and carts trailing after them. On September 1st, we killed our first buffalo. Then there were untold thousands coming in sight. The country was black with them. They had eaten all the grass and fouled all the water holes. On September 9th, we reached the junction of the Bow and Belly Rivers. We turned south to the Sweet Grass Hills. At the Old Man River, we came to our journey's end. A Canadian force, hastily raised, armed and equipped, and not under martial law, in a few months had marched 2,000 miles through a country for the most part as unknown as it proved bare of pasture and scanty in the supply of water.
Whiskey, the first morning of the first day.
Name?
Harry Taylor.
It'll be $25 or 6 months.
I'll pay.
Smash the rest of his kegs.
Oh. Yes, sir. Floods of whiskey spilling out on the ground before a squad of men thirsty to their very souls. Surely a little keg wouldn't have been missed from all that. A wee little keg.
Old Sergeant Blue of the Mounted Police was a so-so kind of guy. He swore a bit and he lied a bit and he boozed a bit on the sly. But he held the post at Snake Creek Bend in the good old British way. And a grateful country paid him about 60 cents a day.
If the police had not come to the country, where would we Indians be now? Bad men and bad whiskey were killing us so fast that very few indeed of us would have been left today. The police have protected us as the feathers of the bird protect it from the frost of winter.
And further, Her Majesty agrees that the said Indians shall be supplied as soon as convenient with the following cattle for raising stock, or in lieu thereof when settled in the reserves and prepared to break up the soil. 2 hoes, 1 spade, 1 scythe, and 2 hay forks, and for every 3 families, 1 plow and 1 harrow, and for each band, enough potatoes, barley, oats.
Treaties. Cattle for buffalo now, the buffalo gone. Harrows and hoes and huts and reservations. Civilization coming.
Indignation meeting. A meeting will be held in the Orange Hall tomorrow night for all the citizens of Mooseman to protest against the late, mean, and despicable action taken by the police in subpoenaing respectable and worthy citizens to give evidence as whiskey sneaks. plus interfering with the liberty of freeborn subjects and is likely to intimidate good citizens from entering hotels. Everyone should attend and protest against such an iron-heeled law, to bear which is to suffer worse than the slaves in Siberia. Arouse ye all!
July 1st, 1876. The Intercolonial finds its way to the sea. Sir Sanford Fleming, the builder, is reported to have scowled at his work.
In order to serve purely local interests, the line was diverted many miles out of its true direction. There was always some prominent politician to advocate the circuitous route. Thus, every person and every ton of goods entering or leaving Nova Scotia has to pay a charge of conveyance over many unnecessary miles. A tax on the traveling public and the commerce of the country forever.
July 1st, 1877.
On the 10th birthday of the new Dominion, St. James Street hung out bunting, but her highways were deserted. A blind woman sat on the doorstep of the Methodist Church, but the voice of her excruciating instrument fared no better than that of wisdom, for no man regarded her. A child of the sunny south with a red nose and a cage of fortune-telling canaries had the run of the Place d'Armes, but there was none anxious to peer into the future. A policeman dragged his frame along Notre Dame Street, looking like one who trod some banquet hall deserted. Along the wharves, a few sunfish browsed cheerlessly. There was an air of repose about the police stations. The fountains in the Vigée Gardens played not to the accustomed crowds of bairns and nurses and afternoon promenaders. For had they not taken what our French neighbors term the key to the fields? And so the chronicler toiled along. At the door of his office, he saw a picture of Dominion Day happiness in the shape of a yellow dog winking one eye to give the other a rest in the interval of snapping at flies. Verily, yesterday, Montreal was not at home.
Money, floating capital, unused funds are more abundant than ever. The cash boxes overflow, the large banks literally sweat with gold, and this excess, this plethora of unemployed capital causes the price of money to decrease. It is the business that is wanting. It is the employment of capital that is in default.
Sleepy and fat, oh, sluggish Montreal. Elsewhere, the voice of high cerebral gloom.
Where shall we serve this Quebec of ours? Stuck up on a promontory like a sore on a horse's back. This city, hardly as large as the palm of your hand, where you can scarcely turn around without tearing your clothes.
Arthur Buys, that terrible young man. Who hears him?
In studying Canadian politics, the first thing to be remembered, though official optimism is apt to overlook it, is that between the British of Ontario and the British of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick are interposed in solid and unyielding mass above a million of unassimilated and politically antagonistic Frenchmen.
Oxford has given Toronto Goldwyn Smith. Oracles speak. They are not wont to listen.
French Canada is a relic of the historical past, preserved by isolation, as Siberian mammoths are preserved in ice. The French Canadians are an unprogressive, religious, submissive, courteous, and, though poor, not unhappy people. They would make excellent factory hands if Canada had a market for her manufacture.
Religious, submissive, courteous, not unhappy? The mammoth rumbles, prisoned in his ice.
The world is full of events. Pregnant questions are brought up. Facts of the highest importance are discussed. And all this does not seem to concern us in the least. Is there anything at all outside the province of Quebec? Yes, since we hear a vague noise, a vast murmuring that falls upon the ear without bringing anything to the mind. Gentlemen, the spectacle offered by the French-Canadian press is probably the most painful and humiliating one can witness. What has brought it so low? Why has it so little weight? It is that our national educational system is defective. I mean that it does not meet the wants of the modern world.
They will be many more, these terrible young, always unheard in Goldwyn Smith's Toronto. Who sees that point of fire within the ice, flickering and failing, always gnawing on?
If our educational system be not entirely changed, if it be not modernized, then in 10 years hence, the line of demarcation between us and the Anglo-Saxons will be clearly drawn, leaving us, of course, in the background.
Canadian nationality being a lost cause, the ultimate union of Canada with the United States appears now to be morally certain.
All clear to the seers at the edge of the 1880s. Gloom in the highbrow east. Yet out by the foothills, where the Mounties went, where the first booze drank dust. The McLeod Hotel. Harry Taylor, proprietor.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, there's a spot where they dump my kegs. Still smells good on a wet day. And the bloody Mounties still walking around in my buffalo skins. But we got some rules here now, boys. Better you read this notice. Rule one, boots and spurs to be removed at night for retiring. Two, every known fluid, water accepted, for sale at the bar. Three, special rates to gospel grinders in the gambling profession. Four, towels changed weekly, insect powder for sale at the bar. Five, all guests requested to rise at 6 a.m. The sheets are required for tablecloth. Six, no mixed drinks served, except in the case of death in the family. Seven, to attract attention of waiters or bellboys, shoot a hole through the door panel. Two shots for ice water, three for a deck of cards. Eight, when guests find themselves or their baggage thrown over the fence, they may consider that they have received notice to quit.
Yeah, Calgary started to come along then, too. Yeah. I remember one winter, the snow drifts covered up the store in the Methodist Church. Only two landmarks we had.
Yeah.
Mail carrier coming from the east missed the town completely and was halfway to Cochrane when a Chinook come in over the mountains.
Yeah?
Well, she melted all the snow in half an hour and he had a swim back.
I wouldn't doubt it for a minute. Knew one winter myself when half the fellas in town had their ears froze off. Blacksmith tried making leather ears for him, but they got soft, and a man couldn't go near a horse without being nuzzled.
Uh-huh.
Then he tried tin ears, and they worked fine, except being very noisy in a hailstorm.
And from the east, another newer sound. Another man who had not heard those seers.
One evening in June 1888, we were six or seven of us in the hall. It was around 9 o'clock when the Abbé Pierre Roussel, secretary to the Université, came in with Maurice Baillarger and Trudel, the great tenor, and with them, a little man, very nervous, very excited, almost bald in the front, an aureole of black hair which fell in ringlets behind his ears. He clapped his hands together, saying, "I've got it! I've got it! I found it at last! I've succeeded! Come, listen!" He took his place at the piano, and for a moment his fingers seemed to communicate an electric current to the keyboard. Then he threw back his head, this Calixa Lavallée. I felt myself transported to the city of Strasbourg on the night when Rouget de Lille played and sang for the first time La Marseillaise.
Time now for the greatest of the Rubicons. Nation to be or not.
If the railroad scheme is utopian, so is Confederation. The two must stand or fall together.
Until this grand work is completed, our dominion is little more than a geographical expression.
Thousands of men and mules and horses slipped into their togs unharnessed night and day.
The grass that fed the buffalo was turned over, the black alluvial mold laid bare, the bed leveled and scraped.
The CPR. Ned Pratt, the poet, tells of its going west.
Subcontractors, gangs of engineers and shovel gangs for bridges, culverts, gangs of mechanics stringing wire, loading, unloading, and reloading gangs, gangs for the fish plates, the spiking gangs. The promise which looked first without redemption was being redeemed. From 3 to 7 miles a day, the parallels were being laid. Though eastern throats were hoarse with the old question, where are the settlements? This was an act of faith indeed, substance of things unseen.
A Northwest wildcat.
The Wall Street Daily News, November 17th, 1883.
There is one stock on the list whose pretensions deserve to be thoroughly exposed. The Canadian Pacific is masquerading around as a 5% security. It is a dead skin. And any investor who buys the stock on the humbugging pretenses made for it will lose every cent.
On the north shore, a reptile lay asleep. The rubbing of her back, these little jabs of steel, were like the burrowing of ticks. These she could stand. But when the breed advanced west on her higher vertebrae, kicking most insolently at her ribs, pouring black powder in her cavities, and making not the clouds but her insides the home of fire and thunder, then she gave them trial of her strength. The trestles tottered, abutments, bridges broke, her rivers flooded. She summoned snow and ice. Muskeg. She took 3 engines, sank them with 7 tracks down through the hidden lake.
George Stephen to John A. MacDonald, December 10th, 1884.
The credit of the company, both at home and abroad, is at the moment gone. I feel like a man walking on the edge of a precipice.
The treasury officer counted his cash and securities, went to his home and valued his paintings, his statuary, his furniture, his household linens, china, and silverware. The old gentleman looked over the long list carefully and without the flicker of an eyelid, signed it all away.
The big one was the mountains. Seas, indeed. With crests whiter than foam, they poured like seas. Whether alive or dead, the bush resisted. The ice could hit men as it hit the spruces. Even the rivers had betraying tricks, all leagued against invasion. At Hell's Gate, a mountain labored and brought forth a bull, which, stranded in midstream, was fighting back the river, and the fight turned on the men. As hard a challenge were the precipices, worn water smooth and sheer 1,000 feet. Out of 100 men, they drafted sailors. They lowered them with knotted ropes and drew them along the face until the lines were strung between the juts. Barefooted, dynamite strapped to their waists, the sappers followed, treading the spider films and chipping holes for blasts until the cliffs delivered up their features under the civil discipline of roads. But that was not enough. Sir John had yet to dip and scrape farther into the public pocket.
I don't know how Council or Parliament will take it.
March 17th, 1885. MacDonald to Charles Tupper.
Stephen asks for a loan for a year of 5 millions. That Tilly can't face. How it will all end, God knows, but I wish I were well out of it.
And out on the prairies where the line lay dead, the gap to the east, the gap to the west, still open. From Superintendent Crozier, Northwest Mounted Police.
Half-breed rebellion, liable at any moment. If half-breeds rise, Indians will join them.
Riel again, the Métis and the Indians. The slow steel crawls, but brings no promise here.
Where grass torn up, or 2 iron lines laid down, stretched away east and west as far as I can see. I say to myself, what is this? Hey, yes, I know. This is to Abisko-Miscano, the iron road that the government has built to carry food and clothing in their big wagons to the poor, starving Indians. And I want them to bring money out and throw it on both sides of the iron road, so that everybody can have plenty of it.
No.
I will lash the telegraph wires until they sing of our need. For the third and last time, I ask you. And when you answer, speak loud, so every Indian can hear. Will you give us beef?
Northwest Not beef, but soldiers rocking the half-laid rails, leaping the eastern gap. Not land, but law for the Métis. For Riel? Riel, that voice that haunts our conscience still.
The day of my birth, I was helpless, and my mother took care of me. The Northwest is also my mother. I am sure that my mother country will not kill me. I believe that I have a mission. I will not be reputed by all men as insane, as a lunatic. I know that through the grace of God, I am the founder of Manitoba. I believe I am the prophet of the new world.
On the 18th of September next, you'll be taken to the place appointed for your execution. And there be hanged by the neck until you are dead. And may God have mercy on your soul.
An electric current is running through Quebec. It was generated in the slip of a rope on the scaffold at Regina. And it will end. Where?
Why is it that this traitor, this apostate, this madman holds so great a place in the mind of the people? What is the mysterious force? Riel will leave no trace in the memories of man by the work he has done, the ideas he has given forth, the doctrines he has preached. And yet his name marks a deep furrow in the political soil of our young country. The reason is that the hand that placed the gallows rope about his neck wounded a whole people. It is because the cry of justice calling for his death has been drowned by the cry of fanaticism calling for revenge.
And for the Indian allies of Riel, Cameron, the traitor, speaks, the Indian's friend.
I walked over to see Wandering Spirit, the war chief of the Crees. He lay outside his lodge, screened from the sun by a blanket on poles above his head, wounded and waiting to be taken to the jail in Regina. "Have you anything to trade?" I asked. "No." He looked toward the lodge. "Ntanus," his daughter came. He spoke with her in a low voice, then stretched out his hand to me with a 10-cent piece in it. "At least I have this. She will spend it with you."
Upon the meeting of the workmen from east to west on the Canadian Pacific Railway, the traveling post office called End of Trail Rocky Mountains ceases to exist.
Hagalaki, British Columbia, November 7th, 1885.
The spike was driven home. The silence, however, continued. And then suddenly, the subdued enthusiasm, the pent-up feelings of men found vent. And as the shouts subsided and the exchange of congratulations began, a voice was heard in the most prosaic of tones, as of a constant daily occurrence.
All aboard! For the Pacific!
The coolies in your poem, Ned?
Frank Scott, the poet, to the other poet.
Where are the thousands from China who swung their picks with bare hands at 40 below? Between the first and the million other spikes they drove, and the dressed-up act of Donald Smith, who has sung their story? Did they fare so well in the land they helped to unite?
Questions, rememberings, and guilts and doubts. Why not? So all men grow. And so a nation grows.
In the latter part of 1890, not quite a year before his death, Sir John A. Macdonald called me to his house. He was sitting before a table strewn with cards.
P.D. Ross of the Ottawa Journal remembers.
How do you do, Ross? You seem to be surprised, I notice.
Ross, you are getting a sidelight on the beauty of public life. Sometimes I take a half hour after lunch and indulge myself with a game of solitaire. Outside of my family, where I've always been happy, you see me at the only sort of recreation I have allowed myself during the past 30 years. But I shall rest soon.
In the autumn of 1894, walking up the street, I joined Sir John Thompson, the Prime Minister. I mentioned a book and asked if he had read it.
No, I would not have the time. I haven't read anything but newspapers and public documents for the past couple of years. My life just now is merely a matter of wearing a rut between my bedroom and my office. I am looking forward with pleasure, I can tell you, to my coming visit to England.
Where, a couple of months later, in Windsor Castle, he died. 1896 and the age of Laurier, the age of the Yukon and the age of the West. North to the passes, following the tinsel dream. West for the land and wheat, the great flood loosed. Never again those empty silences. The dust clouds billow along the line of the steel, the brown grass heaves before the thrust of the plow. By train, by wagon, by ox team, horse and foot, they are coming, the promised men. Men of the dream. What dream?
I came to Calgary with empty pockets. And when the first spring arrived, I was $60 in debt. My farm today consists of 640 acres, with buildings, cattle, and horses.
I only found one chance that first year, to go down to the fields and watch the threshing.
Kathleen Strange.
Around me, vast and golden, stretched the great fields. Belts were whirring, wheels turning. Bundles of grain were flying from wagons into the separator. And from a funnel on one side, a steady stream of chaff and straw was being blown into a huge stack. Here was wheat, steadily flowing from the field to the bin, ready to go out to feed the people of the world.
And now, what is the British hope? Look forward but a generation or two. Our sons, our grandsons will see it. Millions upon millions of British subjects living on their own soil under their own flag. The mind of Canada shall be one mind. The voice of Canada shall be one voice. That as far as she is concerned, she will forever preserve and maintain our glorious empire.
January 1st, 1900, the first day of the new century, the first Canadian shots in the first war. 6,000 miles from home, these sons of empire, fighting the Boers.
They were a marvel to the Cape Town people when the contingent arrived. At the Grand Hotel, the most expensive in the city, some 75 privates dined on Wednesday evening when champagne flowed like dishwater. People fancied that Canada must be a gold mine.
The Union for War has come suddenly, swiftly. 6 months ago, we were not thinking of it. Today, it is an accomplished fact. The man who did the deed was the Right Honorable Joseph Chamberlain. If certain colonial premiers and colonial cabinets hesitated, the colonial secretary knew how to force their hands. The men of Strathcona's horse. They are the lion's whelps, made strong and sturdy by roaming over the lion's preserves. When they meet the enemy, the impact will be such as might be caused were Cromwell's Ironsides to charge once again. For example, in one troop are to be found Mr. Beresford, cousin of the Marquis of Waterford and formerly in the Navy, Mr. Shaw, son of an English baronet, Mr. Warren, a son of Colonel Warren, Royal Horse Artillery, Mr. O'Brien, a relative of Lord Inchiquin, Honorable Mr. Cochrane, a son of Lord Dundonald, and Lord Seymour, a son of the Marquis of Hertford.
And so to Paardeburg, and the end of that.
great sky and the distant treetops reflected the red glare of the burning ammunition wagons and carts that had been fired on by our shells. Great columns of brown smoke rose in the air, only to mingle with the sickly greenish-yellow smoke of the deadly lyddite. The rattle of musketry, the odor of burning flesh, came through the trees on the evening wind, floating from the Boer's lager, while the flare of artillery lighted up the valley. Quite close to one another lay four of our Canadian boys, all dead.
And so to the epilogue, the other voice.
Why were we engaged in that war? Because it was just? Because it was necessary? Because of public opinion? Every French-Canadian newspaper opposed it. The fixed intention of that megalomaniac Chamberlain is to go down in history as the builder of the empire. He could well become the loosener of the empire.
Greatest country I ever struck. There are hundreds of towns and cities between Winnipeg and Moose Jaw. And it takes a rich man to own the ground under his shoes. Wherever there's a siding, that's a town. And where there's a siding and a tank, that's a city.
The unit is the store, and the store is simply a magnified packing box. The merchant likes to have the front boarding carried up to hide the roof. In fact, he likes it ugly. By and by, people build houses to live in on a hotel, and naturally, the packing box style of architecture continues. The trail of early commercial is all over these towns, and necessarily, prosaic lives are made more prosaic and featureless.
It's already 23 years since I first opened fire against barbarisms, anglicisms, and all the other isms whose eruption in our language threaten its disappearance to the last vestige. Useless effort. The Canadiens are incorrigible.
The Women's Literary Club of Toronto has been disbanded to form a Women's Suffrage Association.
I am invited from Paris to give lecture to Art Students League. I want a picture of a horse to show that animal is beautiful because every part made for function. In Paris, I would show woman, but in Toronto, I show a horse.
Our Canada, young, strong, and free, whose scepter stretches far, whose hills look down on either sea and front the polar star. God bless our mighty forest land of mountain, lake, and river, whose loyal sons from strand to strand sing Canada forever.
An earnest and patriotic, but at the same time an unhappy attempt has been made to boom our literature. Like all booms, it has proved unsatisfactory. We're beginning to realize that to scream at one another that we have a literature is not going to give us one.
It is said that the girls of the smaller cities of Canada are in danger of losing their frank charm through their anxiety to know life and grasp its problems, and that they're seeking such knowledge in the pages of the French novelists.
Is it the lack of money that makes Canada so poor a book market? The bald truth is that Canada has the money but would rather spend it on whiskey. What chance has Canada of raising a Sir Walter Scott? The new Sir Walter is probably tramping the streets of Toronto today looking for something to do.
In our schools today, the examinations begin. Scribble, scribble. Nothing oral, nothing of interest, nothing by way of supplement for the enlightened mind. There is no time. The examined scribble for bare life.
The principal occupation of Austria is getting ostrich feathers.
Oliver Cromwell was a man who was put in prison for his interference in Ireland. When he was in prison, he wrote Pilgrim's Progress and married a lady called Mrs. O'Shea.
The two most famous volcanoes of Europe are Sodom and Gomorrah.
In my day, the normal school was sort of educational pork packing factory. It gathered into itself the raw material, rushed it through the machine, scraped off some of the ignorance, but not much, and there stood the manufactured article. I was captured from my native lair, soaked, scraped, and so flung.
We are striving, might and main, to give thousands of young women the education of ladies, save the mark, and permitting them to starve upon the pittance of the sweating house as teachers. And for the result in the schools.
Aim of geography, ma'am? aim of geography is, to fit a man for the business of life and, lead him to prepare for death and the other world.
We should not eat so many bone-making foods as flesh-forming foods because if we did, we would have too many bones, which would make us look funny.
Missionaries are people who get money.
A gentleman is a fellow that has a watch chain and loves Jesus.
Canada's a bloody place for a poet to live his life in.
How utterly destitute of all light and charm are the intellectual conditions of our people and the institutions of our public life. How barren, how barbarous.
If I were English, Canada should love me like the deuce. But I was born in Canada, so what the hell's the use?
W.C. Cullum, north of Regina, thrash 48 bushels of wheat to the acre. S.E. Potter, Moose Jaw, report 4,000 bushels of wheat, averaging over 30 bushels. And J.G. Reed, south of Moose Jaw, 100 bushels to the acre.
What we need is a steadfast, determined policy that we shall smelt our own iron and steel.
From one of the leading hotels of the city of St. John, New Brunswick, at noon on Thursday, May 1st of the present year, 1913, slowly emerged a venerable figure, the cynosure of many eyes. Clad in a fur-trimmed topcoat protecting him from the inclemency of a stormy day, a silk hat surmounting his silvery locks, his shoulders stooped by the burden of years, but his glance still keen and alert, recognizing old friends with a cordial bow, his whole air was one of extreme distinction. Even a stranger would have felt that he was in the presence of no ordinary man. It was Sir Charles Tupper, Baronet, the sole surviving father of Confederation, on his way to the Empress of Ireland.
Leaving his homeland and an age behind him. The father's work was done.
For 400 miles in the rough, shaggy region between Port Arthur and Winnipeg, there's hardly a sign that humanity exists on the earth's face. Only rocks and endless woods of scrubby pine and the occasional strange gleam of water and night and wind, and then Winnipeg. Over this country, there are thrown little pools of that flood of European immigration that pours through Winnipeg. The interminable, bleak, thin rain took the gold out of the wheat and the brown from the distant fields. It seemed to me that the prairie would be a lonely place to live in, especially if it rained. But the people tell me they get homesick if they go away for a time.
In the morning after sunup, we continued our joyous journey down the Athabasca.
Another traveler, Mrs. Arthur Murphy.
The Indian woman on board is returning once more to her native north, with its hidden worlds and yet unhappened things. I tell you that some secret presage lies upon this land, and one who has sensed it must come back again and again to its intangible allurement. It is not for me to know the reason or to tell you, for I am southern-born. Mrs. Jack Fish receives us, seated in her wigwam, because she is very old and quite blind. Truly, she might pass for the honorable great-grandmother of all Canada. Is the kind lady going to the north to find a man? No, the kind lady has white hair, and her man is dead. Ah, well, ah, well. It was different when she was young. Then every woman's skin was full of oil, and for her there were many braves. The factor fills her lap with a heap of pungent tobacco, and we go on. Ah, The religion of the gentle Nazarene has cut the fighting sinews of the Indians. That is why our honorable great-grandmother whimpers for tobacco instead of hurling us over the riverbank and throwing her campfire on top of us. I could almost find it in my heart to wish that she had.
For nearly 200 miles, the train pants through the homeless grandeur of the Rockies and the snowflakes. Yet desolation is not the final impression. There is beauty here. At length, for the first time in Canada, the real beauty that is always too sudden for mortal eyes. I sat and considered the nature of the country in this continent. It is an empty land. To love the country here is like embracing a wraith. A European can find nothing to satisfy the hunger of his heart. The air is too thin to breathe. He requires haunted woods and the friendly presence of ghosts. There walk as yet no ghosts of lovers here. This is the essence of the grey freshness and brisk melancholy of this land. And for all the charm, it is also the secret of a European's discontent. For it is possible, at a pinch, to do without gods. But one misses the dead.
For not much longer now, O doomed young man. The dead will not lie here, but ghosts will walk. You see them round you, living in their thousands, the ghosts to be, and you are one of them. It is 1913. It is Rupert Brooke.
I stood almost in the center of this huge battlefield in the closing hours of a somber March day. To the right, Vimy Ridge rose slowly to the skyline, flaring up at its northern edge into the steeper slopes of the Pimple. At the base of the sloping terraces that came down from the hilltop, the little river Souchet ran, turning northeasterly through the gorge and on toward Lens. This little stream has known its current dammed by the wedged bodies of dead men. Its banks have brimmed with human blood. Over this area, for a distance of miles, the Canadian Corps had planted its camps. But on the March evening when I saw it, it was bleak and cheerless beyond the power of words to express. Everywhere the wreckage of battle, the debris of destruction. A grim and melancholy expanse, yet withal holy ground. For here, men by the tens of thousands had died for mankind. If the dead gave their lives without bitterness, and the living are consoled, Canada, the common mother of both, is richer for all time for their sacrifice. 1,000 years from now, Canadian youths will read the stories of their deeds with kindling eyes.
John Defoe, the man of the free press. And John Defoe in preface to those words.
Though the articles reveal their journalistic origin alike in form and in a certain evanescent timeliness already partly out of date, it has not been considered advisable to recast them.
1919. Already an evanescence, out of date. Stained by the homebred poisons, the other war. Defoe's war with the rest.
In the evening, I went to the St. James Street Methodist Church to attend a recruiting rally.
James Woodsworth, the man of peace. A letter to his wife.
Really, Lucy, if I wasn't on principle opposed to spectacular methods, I would have gotten up and denounced the whole thing as a perversion, a damnable perversion, if you like, of the teachings of Jesus. War anthems favor the Hebrew prophets. War anthems and hymns with war phrases sung as war hymns. It was significant that there were no New Testament lessons.
French Canadians have refused to play their part in this war, being the only known race of white men to quit.
Will you permit me to ask if you have taken the trouble ever to read Regulation 17 affecting the Ontario schools?
Laurier. The aging Laurier.
They try to excuse themselves by alleging domestic grievances.
If it has come to this, that the language of the race to which I belong is proscribed.
The excuse, if true, would be contemptible. In the face of this emergency, domestic questions must stand.
I want to speak to my fellow countrymen in the province of Ontario. I want every child in the province of Ontario to receive an English education. But When I ask that every child of my own race should receive an English education, will you refuse us the privilege of education also in the language of our mothers and of our fathers?
You can do precisely as you please, and we shall do whatever may be necessary. When we demonstrate, as we shall, that a solid Quebec is without power...
Yes, it is now felt that conscription was a failure. But the blind, the fools, and the miscreants who coerce the government to coerce still hold the whip high. And now they are strengthened by those other blind fools and miscreants who at this moment are stirring up the people of Quebec to violence and riot.
Almost the last words. Yet there were these to the young. The nation stood. The nation must go on.
Many problems rise before you. Problems of race division, problems of creed differences, problems of economic conflict, problems of national duty and aspiration. Let me tell you that for the solution, you have a safe guide, an unfailing light. If you remember that faith is better than doubt, and love is better than hate.
Canada is the greatest country under the stars and stripes.
The price of our steel products is fixed in New York. Our Nova Scotia miners obey the orders of a magnate in Indianapolis.
At it again in the world beyond the war, paunchy with fat and bulging with our promise, biting the hand that pours the dollars in. Archibald McMicken tells the horrid tale.
The university curriculums, textbooks, methods of teaching, Greek letter societies, class organizations, the big initial on the football sweater, and the curious war cries known as college yells, all are borrowings from the Americans. Our native game, lacrosse, is dead. Cricket is as sickly exotic. But baseball is everywhere. So is the chewing gum machine. Our fashions and clothes are decreed by New York. Our youth develop knobby shoulders, semi-detachable trousers with permanent cuffs, or hourglass waists, according to the whims of New York. No Canadian ever invents a new form of slang. We have imported Thanksgiving Day, Labor Day, Arbor Day, Mother's Day. And so soon as our cousins south of the line decide to celebrate Grandmother's Day, we shall unhesitatingly adopt it, too.
And Arthur Phelps concludes...
Let any English-speaking Canadian sit down in his corner and divest himself of whatever is American in his origin and impulse, and intellectually he'll look like a skinned rabbit.
You farmers want to keep your boys at home. Don't let them go up to the city. Keep them on the farm. The temptations is more pure.
Aye.
Never again, Senator. The boys have seen Paris. The East is fat. But in the West, the post-war revels ended, the piper to pay. The rains cease. Equally, the wheels fall still. The land lies gray. The thousands gather at silent factory gates. The tumbleweed blows over the blown seed. The dirty 30s. Land of the dry wind now. Anne Marriott tells of it.
They said... Sure, it'll rain next year. When that was dry? Well, next year anyway. Then next. But still the metal hardness of the sky softened only in mockery. When lightning slashed and twanged and thunder made the hot head surge with pain, never a drop fell. Always hard yellow sun conquered the storm. Relief.
God, we tried hard to stand alone.
Relief.
Well, we can't let the kids go cold.
They trudge away to school, swinging half-empty lard pails, to shiver in the schoolhouse, unpainted 7 years, learning from a blue-lipped girl almost as starved as them.
Well, let's forget politics. Forget the wind, our enemy.
Let's forget, farmer boys. Let's put on a dance tonight.
Come on.
the small, uneven schoolhouse floor scraped under big work boots. Gasoline lamps whistled. One Hungarian boy snapped at a shrill guitar. A Swede from out north of town squeezed an accordion dry. And a Scotchwoman from Ontario made the piano dance. Yet, in the morning, air peppered thick with dust, all the night's happiness seemed far away, unreal, like a lying mirage or the icy white glare of the alkali slough.
We are going to see that the people of Alberta are properly cared for.
Out of the dust cloud, Eberhardt the prophet.
Where does all the money come from? We don't use money. Then where does all the credit come from? Why, out of the end of a fountain pen. Social credit is a scientific principle that can be easily understood. Wouldn't I like to have some of those members of Parliament with me for about 5 minutes who claim it's not workable?
We didn't have to wear gunny sacks for clothes and eat gophers like they did down around Youngstown. But I had neighbors who were living on skim milk and potatoes. Then along came Eberhardt, and I saw he was right.
No more for now. Sorry.
The total monthly cost of unemployment in Winnipeg is just now at the rate of $182,000 a month. I do not believe that anyone could begin to picture the moral degradation and the mental hardships that are involved in such figures as these.
Male piece workers in one large Montreal factory average 16 cents per hour. One man of 10 years' experience worked 70 hours per week to earn $7. In one factory, all workers, men and women together, average 25 cents per hour. The banks enjoy the payoff, folks.
Think of tomorrow. Divide your pay in two. Take what you need to live, put the balance in safety.
And the newspapers advertise...
Help a fellow citizen. Buy a smart suit yourself and donate your old one to some needy man.
Into the work camps now, ye hopeful young. See Canada, ye riders of the rods. The empty bellies and the empty boxcars. And then the marching feet, the golden words.
What is the purpose of this march? We have taken care of our unemployed as well as any country in the world. Agitators representing a form of government we will not tolerate, representing communism, got into the work camps to destroy them. You men are the victims of that agitation. You ask for work and wages. You haven't shown much anxiety to get work. It is the one thing you don't want. What you want is adventure. In the hope of overawing authority and upsetting the government.
Mr. Bennett made promises galore. He would end unemployment. He would abolish doles. He would blast his way into the markets of the world. Has he accomplished any of these things?
Had he, Mackenzie King, when rescue came? Mars, the old rescuer, who had not slept.
If I had to find words, Mr. Speaker, in which to express Canada's foreign policy, I would use those words which the Apostle Paul addressed to the Romans when he said to them, "If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men."
Not possible. Another generation grown and ripe. Open the factory doors, pluck men from doles. The war, unfinished, must be fought again. September 7th, 1939.
I have never doubted that when the fatal moment came, the free spirit of the Canadian people would assert itself in the preservation and defense of freedom as it did a quarter of a century ago. I have, however, been anxious that when the inevitable hour came, our people should be as one from coast to coast.
As one. The golden, blood-splashed names go down forever. The far-off places where they sleep as one. Bidding us forget? No, bidding us remember the ancient sores reopened. The newer shame.
For a moment, if you wish to understand me and the French Canadians, reverse the picture, if you please. Try to imagine Canada as part of a French empire and yourselves as a British minority. Would you be as enthusiastic in defending that empire as would be the Canadians of French descent? Think of the position in which we are placed. Think of the concessions which the French Canadians have been making to bring about and maintain unity in this great land of ours. We are here in the House of Commons, all friends, and as members of a family capable of understanding the truth. Where are your concessions, you British Canadians, in favor of the French Canadians? What have you ever done to preserve unity between the two great races in Canada?
I have wept bitter tears over the degradation forced upon us. I have watched the sorry spectacle of human beings in a sworn democracy treated like cattle.
Our population of Japanese origin, Mr. Speaker, is here by our consent. We accepted them as permanent residents of this country. They were no more responsible for the military aggression of the Japanese government than any other citizen of Canada. And despite the way we have treated them, despite the fact that we denied them the rights enjoyed by every other citizen, not one disloyal act has been committed by any Canadian-born Japanese.
To custodian of Japanese properties of Vancouver, B.C. Dear Sir, we cannot understand the official claim that it is necessary to sell over our heads the home from which we were forcibly ejected. This house, bought out of our slender earnings, represents our stake in this country of our birth. We do not quarrel with military measures, but this act can scarcely be in accord with any war measure. Please hasten to assure us that our house is inviolable. Thank you. Yours truly, T.M. Kitagawa, for Mr. and Mrs. E. Kitagawa.
Mr. Elizaburo Kitagawa, registration number 01842. Dear Sir, the proposed liquidation is a general one and not only applies to your particular property. I am unable to give you the assurance asked for.
Dear Sir, the reason for writing you at all was because the government had vested in you the final authority to sell or not to sell our homes, and perhaps I took a vain hope gamble. You, who deal in lifeless figures, files, and statistics, could never measure the depth of hurt and outrage dealt out to those of us who love this land. It is because we are Canadians that we protest the violation of our birthright. You have piled indignity upon indignity on us. You have sought to sully and strain our loyalty. But I'm telling you, you can't do it. If all fails and you are upheld in your purpose, then kindly send us our proceeds that we may personally invest them in something solid. Victory bonds, for instance.
Have orderly decontrol,
prescribes Frank Scott.
First, we must give away all the assets of war. Stores, trucks, equipment, goods of every kind, and all the factories built with public money. These must be channeled toward monopolies which will most surely exploit them. We must show how carefully and consciously we can steer toward disaster, letting the forces of anarchy return.
Into the 50s, on toward today, the sharp-tongued poets snapping at our heels. Blackness behind, the mushroom cloud above, star-spangled airwaves beating at our ears.
wondrous sweet music that I hear. Is it soap or is it beer?
Inquires Frank Scott again.
Do I owe the string quartet to foulness of the breath or sweat? When the Chopin prelude comes, will it help massage the gums? And will Sirkin play encores mixing Bach and baseball scores? Damn, they've cut the Bach finale. Your world's my world, Mr. Dolly.
Joining the Confederation was a good thing for Newfoundland, and the terms were fair enough.
We can't see the small wood for trees, and we know that the seafaring folk would never have sunk to their knees if they hadn't been utterly broke.
But I felt sick to my stomach, I can tell you, on that day we walked up to the center block on Parliament Hill for the signing.
Tenth of the sisters comes to take potluck. Onward with all, reluctant sister, now. Tell us, O seers and travelers, what we are.
You have asked me an enormous question.
Dick Diesbecker.
Now I must tell you. You are the quiet bays and the lonely shadows of the firs. You are the rocky mountains white with the snows of centuries. You are the United Empire loyalists, seigneurs, habitants, and priests, the fathers of Confederation.
A dull people, enamored of childish games.
Irving Layton.
Deferring to beadle and censor. Not ashamed for this, but given over to horseplay, the making of money.
You are Naranda, Braylon and Lakeshore Mines, Hollinger and Sullivan and Froud. You are Dominion Bridge and Cockshut Plough, International Nickel and Massey Harris, Shawinigan, Beauharnois, B.C. Power.
Strange, haunting and full of exciting sounds are the names of Canada.
Bruce Hutchison.
The name itself is strange enough, like the cry of some wild seabird. Some say it came from the Iroquois, some from the Algonquin. There is also the legend of the Spanish sailors who, failing to find gold mines, cried, Acá, nada. There is nothing of value here.
As I snoop round my old hometown on the prairies, I hear a good deal about people I grew up with.
Wallace Stegner.
Most of it concerns how they married an American millionaire or made it big as geologists for Standard Oil or tour the country every year giving piano recitals or have become newspaper publishers in Regina or teachers or doctors or executives somewhere else. Always somewhere else. White mud has become an exporter of manpower.
Various sources of information had led me to believe that our journey across Canada would be a succession of jolly and informative encounters with folksy characters sitting on benches, stones, logs, etc.
Edward McCourt sets out across the land.
I had confidently expected to meet in the Maritimes tarry old yarn, spinning salts, exuding local color and rum fumes. And the West I knew was overrun by leather-skinned, crinkly-eyed farmers ready at the click of a tape recorder to sum up in a succinct phrase, punctuated by a stream of tobacco juice, the essential spirit of the prairies.
She's a next year country, son. Say, let's go gather up a bucket of them gall-darn hailstones and make a freezer ice cream.
I never met any of them. Perhaps they were all off making tapes for the CBC.
And yet, old friend McCourt, to quote yourself, quoting your Gaelic friend...
She bade us farewell in Cape Breton with a blessing we liked.
May your road rise with you. May the wind blow always at your back. May the good Lord hold you in the hollow of his hand.
How shall we speak of Canada, Mackenzie King dead? The mother's boy in the lonely room with his dog, his medium, and his ruins.
Frank Scott. Once more, Edward McCourt rejoins.
How, after all, do we explain to foreigners the attempt of a prime minister whom we kept in office for 21 years to build in the middle of a Canadian cow pasture a ruined Greek temple from the door of a 19th century bank? How do we explain it to ourselves? The girl from the Department of External Affairs who showed us around Kingsmere shivered a little in the warm sunlight.
If he put up all this junk thinking it was art, that's awful. But if he put it up because he really liked it, because it did something to him, my God.
I found Kingsmere immensely comforting. for it assures us that the ultra-conventional little horse trader, who in our more despondent moments we equate with the national character, was at times, perhaps during certain phases of the moon, a nonconformist beyond the wildest imaginings of the most nihilistic, pot-smoking pad dweller among us. If Kingsmere, through Mackenzie King, reflects a facet of the national character, there is hope for us yet.
The cadence of the typical Canadian voice is different from the Americans. It is half nasal twang, a quarter Scots, quarter Irish, and has a rather sad tone, as if something once dear and now lost and forgotten is still being endlessly regretted. There is in Canada, too, somewhere seated on the throne of power, a man who continually says no to life.
Anybody ever really heard that voice? Anybody give that answer now, today? What of the voice Jack Priestley did not hear?
Joual is a boneless language. It is to say joual instead of cheval, horse. It is to talk as horses would talk if they had not long since plumped for silence and the smile of Fernandel.
I remember the first letter.
André Lorando.
It was from a simple lay brother of one of our far-off religious communities. Thus was born Brother Anonymous.
It is a symptom of our non-existence as French Canadians. Our inability to assert ourselves, our refusal to accept the future, our obsession with the past, are all reflected in joual, our real language. We live joual because our souls are impoverished. The whole French-Canadian society is foundering. If we are to be saved, energetic measures are called for. The axe! We must work with the axe!
Why, Brother Anonymous? In a sense, he was the first come, no matter who, of the army of brothers. He incarnated the best of our own, all those whom we never hear.
I make jokes, I play the clown, I pass out insults, of course, but that's not all. The main thing is that I love the people hereabouts, the French Canadians of my province. I'm so much one of them, rooted in this land. I make a fuss because I don't want my people to miss the boat. We mustn't miss the boat. We're far enough behind anyhow.
Oh, Goldwin Smith, the Siberian mammoth wakes. The point of fire has eaten through the ice. The glacier moves.
All this Canadian excitement of newness and hope, this bustle of aspirations, you can sense most potently in Montreal. A slight suggestion of violence hangs in the air. Here you can understand what it means to stand on the edge of a new world.
The die is cast in Canada.
Pierre Elliott Trudeau.
There are two ethnic and linguistic groups. Each is too strong and deeply rooted in the past, too firmly bound to a mother culture to be able to swamp the other. But if the two will collaborate, Canada could become a privileged place where the federalist form of government, which is the government of tomorrow's world, will be perfected.
Tomorrow's world, and we of this 100th year, we of this quarrelsome, so well-loved land, kicked in the ribs by those who love her best. What do we fear but not to be fulfilled? How are we small but by the measure of our hope?
Drive the highway from coast to coast, by snow-crowned mountains and wide empty spaces, and the tumbled chaos of rock and lake and forest, and the tumultuous surging life of great cities. And you are aware, every mile you drive, that less than a day's journey north begins one of the last great wildernesses of Earth, a wilderness which dwarfs into utter insignificance the narrow band of settlement.
Even in the northernmost islands of the Arctic archipelago, less than 400 miles from the North Pole, during the short Arctic summer, one may find veritable rock gardens, gay with purple Lapland rhododendrons and loco weeds, with arnicas and yellow Arctic poppies, with creamy white avens and masses of purple, white, or yellow saxifrages and tiny rock ferns.
I tell you that some secret presage lies upon this land, its hidden worlds and yet unhappened things.
We are a people subconsciously aware of mighty, imminent forces, subconsciously aware of the gods.
Century, researched and written for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation by Joseph Shule with Frank Underhill. Directed and produced by J. Frank Willis.